Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The New Statesman.
Hello, I'm Anoushka Kellyan, Britain editor of The New Statesman, and you're listening to The New Statesman podcast. Today, I'm joined by Will Dunn, The New Statesman's business editor, and Ellen Pearson-Hagger, our assistant culture editor, to discuss why the UK's housing crash is just beginning. Today, we're diving into a critical issue that hits close to home for many across the UK: the state of our housing market, and specifically, the dire state of the rental market. Housing in the UK has become increasingly unaffordable during the last two decades. Buying a home is an unattainable prospect for many in the country, and the challenges facing renters are now reaching a tipping point. And we're here together, each of us, because we've been looking at and reporting on different aspects of the housing crisis over the past few weeks and the sort of wider effects that it's having on all of our lives. Will, do you want to tell us a bit about what you've been looking into?
Yes, I've been mainly looking at the way the housing market, house prices and rents, is changing as a result of what's changing in the wider economy, especially the change in the price of debt, because almost everybody who buys a house buys it with debt, and a lot of people who rent a home are paying off their landlord's debt by doing so. So that's the principal change that underlies all of it, is how expensive is it to borrow, and that's what has this this enormous effect on the wider economy, because it cuts into people's disposable incomes as well.
And Ellen, when we talk about the housing crisis, we often talk about people who can't afford their rent or they can't buy a house. But of course, when rents go up, it means people who run public venues are also in trouble. You've been looking into that.
Yeah, exactly. I've been researching and reporting on how landlordism affects our cultural spaces and the arts life in the UK. And even as a journalist who's been reporting for some years now on art spaces and the culture industries, I was surprised myself to learn just how much of an impact landlordism has on the viability of our cultural spaces. And that arts venues, cinemas, music venues don't own buildings is a huge problem for our cultural life in the UK.
And it is affecting the state of our towns as well. Even if you aren't directly, if you're lucky enough not to be directly affected by the housing crisis, it will still be having an impact on your neighbourhood. That's something I've been looking at, the number of councils that are at risk of bankruptcy because they are no longer able to supply enough temporary accommodation for people who end up homeless in their areas. That's a statutory duty they have to fulfil, but they just don't have the places to put them in, and that's pushing their budgets to breaking point and, you know, really pulling at the fabric of some towns around the country. But let's get an update on the actual state of the housing market at the moment, Will. Everyone's sort of saying that house prices are going down, but that's not quite true, is it?
Well, so there's been a couple of, it's always possible to find two headlines about house prices that will directly contradict each other. And that's because there are two different, very distinct ways of looking at the economy. So, if you've been on BBC News website this month, you would have seen headlines saying house prices rise for the first time in 6 months and house prices see biggest monthly rise for more than a year. And that sounds like, oh, that's, you know, back in business for house prices. But equally, last week you would have seen a headline, I'm not sure if BBC reported it, but saying the prices have undergone their first annual fall since 2012. And that's the more realistic picture. So prices do normally rise in the autumn. People have a look at houses over the summer and then kind of complete in the autumn. October is normally the biggest month. But this October has been the weakest month, the weakest October since 2008. And even that is, that little dip in house prices of sort of 2 to 3%, depending on where you measure from. That's a nominal change. And that's the really important thing, is that's happening in a year of very high inflation. So from March 2022 to September of this year, in real terms, house prices fell by well over 13%. Savills, the estate agents, have said that average real house prices by October weren't any higher than they were at the end of about 2015. So the housing crash is still going on, and it will continue to go on for some time. Because next year, about another 1.6 million households will come to the end of their fixed rate mortgages. And the mortgages are much more expensive than they were when those people took them out. So if they're 2-year fixed rates or 5-year fixed rates, those will all be more expensive, but some of them by really quite a lot. Because despite the adults being back in the room in the economy since the Truss episode, that hasn't stabilized government bond prices all that much, which are the main sort of one of the main references by which mortgages are priced. So there'll be a lot of people paying a fair bit more every month. And the main underlying point about house prices is just the thing that inflated them has stopped. So, you know, after the financial crisis in 2008, the Bank of England started doing quantitative easing, which I won't go into an enormously long explanation of, but it inflates assets. So it inflates share prices, it inflates things that are already owned, and particularly inflated house prices by a lot. And governments knew that was happening, but they still stepped in, because rather than saying, well, we're doing this one thing on the one hand, which is inflating the cost of buying a house, so we'll do something else to address that. The thing they did was to further pump the market with things like Help to Buy, which was 29 billion quid's worth of government-backed loans to first-time buyers to try and cram more people into the already overheated market. And those things aren't happening anymore. They're not doing Help to Buy anymore. QE isn't happening anymore. The opposite of QE is happening. Interest rates are higher. Mm. So there isn't any reason to expect that house prices will have, you know, the same kind of upwards momentum that they had in the past. Even with house builders doing less building, it's unlikely that you'll get the same stimulus on that kind of level. The good news is that falling house prices are really good. You know, they're good for everyone. It's not, you know, like nobody complains about all the price of bread's going down, or the price, you know, it's a kind of inflation that people have been kind of tricked into thinking worked as a sort of substitute for growing wages, or for, you know, not having the same pensions that people in previous decades had. People were tricked into thinking, well, my house is going up by loads in price, so that will kind of work as a pension, or, you know, that will make up for the fact that my real wages haven't really grown. But obviously then you get to a turning point like this in the economy, and they start to stagnate against inflation or go down. And that kind of fairy gold turns back into leaves again. But you know, so the illusory growth that was created isn't there anymore. But you know, if people's wages are given some years to catch up to house prices, then that will be good, because, you know, obviously making it more affordable for first-time buyers to buy a house is good. But also, you know, if it's good for everyone. Because, you know, the gap between the property you might buy next gets smaller if the prices are smaller. The only thing that rising prices do is makes it more expensive to move. Mm. People take out bigger and bigger mortgages. So it's kind of a long-term picture of stagnation or falling market, but that's probably all right for most people. The real problem is rents, because the other effect of this change in the direction of prices, as reported recently, is the fact that for decades people have bought houses to rent out to other people. It's been it's government policy and monetary policy have made it a very sound investment, because you get a return from your rent, get somebody paying off your mortgage, and the price of your asset, the house, would go up. So It was kind of a no-brainer. And you don't have to pay national insurance contributions as a landlord. So, you know, it's been very easy to make money from the rentier economy. But the maths on that have now changed. So it's now too expensive to pay the rent interest for most buy-to-let, small buy-to-let landlords to really get into the market and actually make any money out of it. And that is putting pressure on the supply of rental properties as landlords get out of the market. And that means that rents are forecast to continue rising quite a lot. There's quite a wild divergence of forecasts on rents. And personally, I think some of the forecasts that have been made for how high they will get are unrealistic, because I just don't think the rental market can support that much more. You know, people just won't be able to squeeze renters that much harder. And we see this in London, because there was a trend from about 2013 up till just before the pandemic. People in their 20s were gradually moving out of London because they just couldn't afford to live there anymore. And that trend was sort of halted by the pandemic to a certain extent, because it just changed the dynamics of where people were moving anyway. But that trend has resumed. So a recent survey found that nearly half of renters in their 20s who moved outside the capital, which is, that's a resumption of that trend. And that's one of the, just one way of looking at what Ellen's been reporting on, which is the way in which this particular kind of inflation affects culture. It kind of, you know, sort of dissolves the communities that people can build up, the cultural institutions they can create, the things they can participate in. You know, London is a city that's culture relies on the influx of young people looking for jobs, either from around the country or from abroad. If they can't afford to live here, it'll be a very different place.
Yeah, and it affects the electoral map as well, interestingly. We've been talking a lot on the sort of political podcast about the changing politics in places like the home counties and suburbia, because you do have these people who you mentioned moving out of expensive cities and taking their political values with them to areas that otherwise, you know, hadn't been populated by these groups. So it does have a big societal impact. I mean, Ellen, what's been the parallel impact for people who are struggling to pay the rent on, I think you looked into music venues, pubs, cinemas, everything that we can expect on a high street to make our lives culturally rich?
Yeah, well, I think kind of stepping back a bit, most shocking to me was even to think about the fact that when you have a venue, say a popular cinema chain, take Curzon, you know, the big Curzon cinema in Mayfair in London, that's been there a really long time. You think about it as Curzon, it's the cinema, that's the building. Actually, Curzon, the brand, doesn't own that building. They're subject to a landlord. And it's not so much in the cases that I was seeing, it's not so much that these venues couldn't pay the rent, but actually that their landlords were choosing to kick them out of the buildings. So the case that's ongoing with Curzon in Mayfair is that the holding company, which is based in Jersey, 38 Curzon lease, plans to end Curzon's lease in order to renovate the building. Curzon have told me that cinema wouldn't otherwise close. It's financially viable. It's obviously got a great spot in the centre of London's West End, and it's particularly popular for events and premieres. But the landlord intends to renovate the building to open its own cinema on the site, pushing out a brand that's been there for 90 years because they think that there's a better way to profit from the building. So it's not, I mean, obviously would be awful if these places couldn't afford to pay the rent as it is, but it's not even that. It's even worse. It's that they're not being able to continue to put on performances or the showings or to have the community space they have had until now. And it's happening all over the arts. So there's the Curzon example. It's also happening a lot with music venues. And I came across this idea really through the work that the Music Venue Trust is doing. They're an organization that supports small grassroots music venues, which they define as, small to medium-sized venues that focus on showcasing new music. So this is not your O2 Academies, It's you know, small community spaces, maybe just with 100 capacity, but they're really important for keeping regional music alive, particularly outside of cities. And also for getting bands on the touring circuit. The classic thing is that, you know, even artists as big as Ed Sheeran once played grassroots venues. Everyone has to start out somewhere, and that's how you rise. According to data from the Music Venue Trust, more than 35% of grassroots music venues have closed in the last 20 years, which is a huge amount, you know, more than a third. And really interestingly, 93% of those are tenants. And the typical operator has just 18 months left on its tenancy. So the idea is that there are people, you know, business people, music lovers, music fans who have set up a business and they're supporting their local art scene. But with just 18 months on a tenancy, just like as a renter with a few months left on your housing tenancy, there's no way to plan for the future. Obviously, the pandemic made the live events space even more difficult. And, you know, in my reporting, speaking with various venue owners, I know that the effects of that are still being felt, as of course, the effects of the cost of living crisis, people feeling they just don't have the disposable income to buy big tickets, cinema tickets, theatre tickets, whatever it might be. So there's a number of problems, but the very fact, I think, that these cultural spaces can't feel secure in their building and know that they'll be there in a couple of years' time means that there's lots of things they just can't do. And also, it's a bit like being a private renter in terms of housing, and that, you know, they wouldn't just be able to renovate the building, maybe put a new bar in, knock a wall down, open a space to do something else with it. Business owners are very limited, just like a renter is, any of us who rent our flats and couldn't just suddenly paint a wall black if we wanted to. So I think we have to be really careful when we're thinking about the particular situation that these owners are in. And as I say, you know, it goes from a small music venue to a brand like Curzon, which you assume is secure, but it's just not the case because of the way that the ownership rights are around these buildings.
I think that's a really good example of just sort of how corrosive it is to concentrate on sort of non-productive assets in your economy. You know, just, you know, those businesses that Ellen's talking about, even a very small, you know, sort of community arts centre, like those are productive businesses that are then, you know, helping other businesses like, you know, acts or, you know, sort of musicians to create stuff that they're going to sell to other people. That's, you know, that's productive economic activity. And some of that, Ed Sheeran, whatever you think of his music, I'm not going to share my views on your podcast, is a major export. You know, that, yeah. You know, and Britain does very well out of its cultural exports. That's extremely important to our economy. And if you have other businesses that are just kind of shunting that aside in order to concentrate on the returns from the non-productive asset, you know, they're not necessarily creating more jobs or more products to sell into the economy from the inflation of the cost of that property that they own, then you're doing some economic damage, like, right across the economy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, and a good example of that is some of the places that I've been looking at that have been suffering a sort of perfect storm of all of these different factors that we're talking about, from rents being too expensive to houses being out of reach to, you know, a scarcity in housing stock. And I think the place where this is most extreme in the country at the moment is in Hastings, which is on the Sussex coast. It's a poor town, but it's close to London, which is, you know, quite a toxic combination for an area. It also happens to be beautiful as well, which makes things, you know, sometimes good for the tourism sector there, but very difficult in terms of the gentrification trend, which has meant lots of Londoners have moved down, particularly during the pandemic, on London salaries, been able to buy up quite what was quite cheap housing, which has then become out of reach to locals. So the typical, let's just take Hastings as an example. The typical rent for a one bed flat there is now £805 a month, which is huge in a town where the median full-time salary is £25,500. And this is the area where rents have risen 11.7%. That's more than double the average rise that was over 2022 to 23. And house prices have also doubled there in 10 years, which is one of the biggest spikes that we've seen anywhere in England. And the impact that this has on locals is that they can't afford to rent or to buy in the place that they've grown up in and that they work in, often in quite low paid service sector jobs. So they become homeless. And I think there's a misunderstanding slightly in the public perception of what homelessness means. Most homeless people are not living on the streets, you know, rough sleeping, as the phrase goes. They are stuck having to be in temporary accommodation, you know, inappropriate housing for their needs, often sometimes bed and breakfasts and sort of bed sits. This is called temporary accommodation, and it's down to your council to provide that room for you. But the problem is, because there's nowhere to put people, because there's been so few houses built, you know, this isn't unique to Hastings, but there's been far too few houses built there over the past few decades. It's costing Hastings, which is having to use all sorts of different places like hotels and things, 5.6 million this year on temporary accommodation, which is half its entire council's budget. And so that doesn't just affect, you know, the people who are waiting to find housing. It also affects everyone who uses council services in Hastings. It affects the roads and the libraries and social care and everything else that councils, the bins, have to spend their money on. So, you know, Ellen's talked very vividly about the effect that this can have on our cultural life, but it's also our sort of the public realm, the way that we interact with our neighbourhoods. It's having an impact on that as well. Even if, you know, you're one of those Londoners lucky enough to have bought somewhere cheap in Hastings and have quite a good quality of life, you don't want to see your town degrading that way either.
No, and it's also just to, on some of the other reporting that you've done, on councils that have been bankrupted, or I know councils can't technically go bankrupt, but we'll use that phrase, or near bankrupted by the ways in which they've had to try to make money because they were, you know, the really long-term picture is that when councils were told to sell off their council housing under right to buy under Margaret Thatcher, the beginning of the 1980s, they're also told by the Treasury that they, you know, they had to meet certain requirements before they could borrow anything at all to build more housing. And instead, the councils effectively stopped building. House building was taken over by people who were doing it for profit. And then councils now, as you're reporting from Hastings shows, have to spend all this money on finding accommodation for people that they could have built in previous decades, and they would now be effectively making a return from or not having to spend money on. And instead they spent it on these mad schemes like shopping centres, or gone into business with some quite questionable people who have seen the council coming and thought, I know they're desperate for returns because they've got all these obligations.
And I know they can't go bankrupt, so I know the government will always underwrite it in the end. There's been a number of different examples of councils that I've written about who have, you know, speculated. And actually, they were encouraged to do this. They were encouraged to make these riskier investments in the coalition years when they were cutting their budgets. They were saying, but you can invest in X, Y, and Z. And they're not seeing, many of those places aren't seeing returns on those investments, which again has a direct impact on people's lives. And I just want to say one more thing about Hastings, actually, which I think is probably the most shocking fact that I found there. The leader of the council had actually called for a Homes for Ukraine style scheme in Hastings. That was the refugee scheme that the UK government introduced when Russia invaded Ukraine, to take in refugees here into people's houses, but for locals. You know, can you open your spare rooms? Can you give up a space in your garden where you can build a prefab for someone who doesn't have a place to live? I mean, it's quite extraordinary that Britain in the 21st century has to make that kind of call.
Yeah, it's absolutely shocking.
But there are some alternative ways that some people are trying to do things in a very hostile environment. I mean, I spoke to this grassroots community landlord in Hastings that were hooking rents to the median income. And I spoke to some people who were managing to live affordably there. But, you know, it was on a small scale, and it's about how you scale up those kind of schemes. Ellen, you found some similar models that venues were trying to adopt, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I've looked into a number of different venues and programs, and a lot of them are using community ownership as a way to raise funds to buy the building from the landlord, ensuring that a building stays with the business, and therefore the business has security in the future. It's an idea that has been around for a long time, and I think one of the areas in which we've seen community ownership be most successful is with our pubs in the UK. The Campaign for Real Ale reckons that there are about 150 pubs in the UK that are community owned. And actually my local pub in Nunhead in South London is one of them. The Ivy House was closed in 2012 and sold to a property developer. And they planned to gut the whole building and turn it into flats. And if any of our listeners have been the Ivy House, you'll know what a shame that would have been, because it's an amazing historic building which has the gorgeous 1930s music hall in its centre. It's really, really interesting architecturally, and obviously also hugely important as a social and community space for the local area. But a group of regulars applied to English Heritage to get the building Grade 2 listed status, to have it categorised as an asset of community value, which protects a building from an immediate sale. And so with that extra time, the group fundraised and managed to buy the pub from the owners before it could be sold to the developer. And in 2013, the Ivy House reopened as a community-owned, community-run pub. And 10 years later, it's still open. It's a great community hub. They put on all sorts of different events, reading group, really important social initiatives for the community, as well as being a live music space. So this kind of model of community ownership is something that is being talked about in more and more sectors. The Music Venue Trust, the initiative I mentioned earlier, have done a similar thing with a scheme that they launched last year called Music Venue Properties. And they had a list of grassroots music venues around the UK that they were hoping to buy back from the landlords with this community ownership model. So anyone from, you know, average music bands to big investors, such as some of the country's biggest record labels, were able to invest in this scheme. And the first of those sales went through earlier this year. And that's of The Snug, which is a grassroots music venue in Atherton, in Greater Manchester. It's just 100 capacity. It's one of very few live music spots in the area, and it's used as a coffee shop in the daytime, turns into a gig room at the weekend, but it's a really important community asset, the space. And the building was up for sale, and the owner of The Snug didn't own the building. The landlord wanted to sell it, and probably the owner thinks to turn it into flats, because she's seen lots of local commercial properties bought up and turned into flats in the area. But because of this music venue property scheme, the building has been bought by the so-called friendly landlord of the Music Venue Trust. And so long as The Snug operates as a music venue, it will be secure in its tenancy, which, as I've said, is vital for the kind of development that we need and the kind of sustainability that we need in the sector. And I think it's really important to think of, you know, obviously we've spoken about housing and the impact on people's lives. And of course, having a secure home is a human right. But also when we're thinking about the kinds of towns and cities that we'd like to live in, we all know, you know, a town, a city is a better place if there are music venues, theatres, cinemas, pubs, community spaces, not purely for the sake of the arts and the culture and the entertainment that happens there, but just to have spaces where people can come together and share ideas, share stories, be with other people. So I think thinking about landlordism within this cultural space is imperative. And I think we need to be having more and more conversations about the ways that landlordism affects the arts. Because as I said before, it isn't something that I see talked about much change. You know, we talk about venues closing because of licensing issues or because of rising energy costs. The whole kind of late night alcohol licensing issue is a common one. But to be thinking about who really owns our buildings and our premises and the brands that we love, I think is vital.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you. And there is an irony, isn't there? Because you're talking about what kind of towns, cities, neighbourhoods we want to live in. Often, at first, it's in the interest of the landlord or the housing developer to make an area into a sort of desirable location before they build the houses. So I've been writing about this trend called meanwhile space, where, you know, perhaps underused high streets and vacant units are done up in a nice way and, you know, nice local businesses that otherwise might not have been given a chance to put into these places, and they become quite artistic and exciting to people who want to move to perhaps an area that's a bit more affordable but doesn't have much going on there. And these are often backed by housing developers and the people who are going to profit from it. Knocked down and then housing is put in as soon as they've got the interest sort of ramped up in the area. So there's that strange sort of artificial culture that's sometimes pumped in somewhere because of the landlordism that you've just been talking about, Ellen. But there's obviously, you know, there is knowledge among these people of what they need to draw, particularly younger people, to an area. And that's now being exploited as well.
I remember hearing about a London property developer who would, before he started doing up a block of flats, he would open a bookshop on the same street because everyone wants to live near a bookshop. And then the bookshop wouldn't last all that long after the flats have been sold. It's incredibly cynical. But it is, yeah, like you say, it's an irony. But, you know, the fact that somewhere has cultural institutions makes people want to live there because there's just more to do, you know, more chances, as Ellen said, to spend time with other people. But then that also, you know, causes property prices to inflate, which imperils those institutions because the owners of them then think, well, I could get more out of this if I turned it into the kind of housing that everyone else is buying. So you do need some sort of mechanism to protect that, or you just have this constant cycle of people seeing it solely as a means of making money. And, then the people who have moved to those places then watch them degraded by the thing that caused them to move there.
Yeah, I mean, we've been looking into, for a separate piece, Will, into lots of these schemes, these housing schemes, which are quite new, where people have been left without the things they were promised. Often they're promised that there would be a pub on the estate or even a GP surgery or a primary school, and these things just don't appear once the builders leave town.
It also works the other way. I suppose if younger people, for example, are being pushed out of London because they can't afford to live here, and I know it's the same with other major cities, has an impact on the ticket sales for live music, comedy, theatre, whatever it is. Of course, older people and other kinds of people go to those events as well. But if we're thinking about that kind of younger market, as well as the general cost of living crisis and people not being able to afford those tickets, but if people aren't living in the major cities, then they cease to become cultural hubs.
Yeah,
anyway.
Absolutely. And like you, Ellen, I met someone, I met this group. It was sort of half community land trust, half social enterprise, that were buying up old buildings, sort of disused buildings, to turn into both workspaces, cultural spaces and flats, affordable to rent to their tenants. And I asked the woman who ran it, this organisation is called Hastings Commons, and it's sponsored by various groups. You mentioned I think you mentioned Historic England. I think that was one of their funders, National Lottery, and some local funders as well to help them buy the buildings. And she said, you know, we'd love to do it on a grander scale and we'd love it to happen around the country. There are some other examples of this kind of thing happening around the country, but, you know, the policy atmosphere is extremely hostile. And I wonder, Will, what kind of thing do you think the government or an incoming government could bring in to try and make the housing crisis sort of less acute for people? You've seen actually in the King's Speech, they did bring in this renters reforms bill, but even scrapping no-fault evictions, which has been promised since 2018, even that is delayed now because they need to reform the courts in order to be able to have some kind of mechanism if a landlord does want to evict a tenant but can't use that Section 21 notice anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really difficult problem to solve because there has been, like I said, this enormous movement of wealth as a result of policies that weren't directly housing policies necessarily, you know, particularly monetary policy, but also more closely related policies like Help to Buy, where they have just, you know, they've moved an enormous amount of money around, and then it would take a great deal of effort to turn back the clock on that. I think most people agree that you need a lot more house building, but you need house building of a particular kind. Mm-hmm. So just having a target to build a certain number of houses isn't necessarily going to help. I mean, there are 250,000 empty houses in the UK. It's about where people want to live, you know, where people can get to work from. It's also about, you know, just I think one of the main things to do is to be honest with people about the effect that we've been talking about of rising property prices and how they're not actually free money. They are, you know, a socially, culturally, and economically corrosive. Mm-hmm. And to set that out and then to say, so we are going to do things that, you know, allow this market to, I mean, I can't really see any government saying we're going to allow a particular market to stagnate, but we are going to manage this market more closely so that as house builders, you know, get back into building again, as people are buying properties, it's not subject to the same galloping inflation that it's had for, you know, over 15 years since the crash. And then before that in the 80s and 90s, there are other periods of very high inflation in housing. That all resulted from, you know, good intentions, just having these unintended side effects. And then separately, yeah, you just need a much higher standard of rent protection. And you need new landlords. That might be private companies. There are some arguments for why that they might be good at that rather than, you know, individuals renting houses to one another. Companies can be more accountable. But, you know, what's worked in the past is obviously social landlords is councils really having the money to do that. But, I mean, you could almost look at the enormous movement of wealth as, you know, from the Thatcher era to now as being a movement of wealth from local councils, from, yeah. you know, publicly held assets of housing into the private sector. And that's, yeah, once you privatise something, it's very difficult to get it back.
Yeah, and unfortunately with councils in the state that they're in, they're often not great landlords even when they are still running housing, as we've seen from the state of social housing in some parts of the country as well. Well, thanks so much, both of you. Your pieces on this have been brilliant, and hopefully there'll be plenty more. Thanks, Ellen, for joining us. I think, is this your debut on the New Statesman podcast?
I think it is, yeah.
Wow.
About
wow.
time.
Brilliant. Yeah, it is. Yeah, we'll definitely have you back. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. You can read all the reporting mentioned in this episode via the links in the show notes. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Will Dunn and Ellen Pearson-Hager. Follow us on your podcast app to make sure you get new episodes as soon as they're released. You can also watch video from this podcast on our YouTube channel. Just search YouTube for New Statesman. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.